Committee on Veterans from the House and the Senate will come to order.
And then just wrap it.
Right.
We're here too. House is here.
And the House is here. Colleagues, before, I guess Chair Matthews is, I understand, is the interim.
Fire Chief at Gresham.
Fire Chief at Gresham, and there's a fire issue, so he was recalled from being the chair here to do something with fires in Gresham. So hopefully there's no state troopers out there on the road between here and Gresham, because he'll get a ticket driving what he drives. And so he's not going to be here. Colleagues, before I jump into the informational hearing we have right now, Chair Matthews and I have been discussing with Boley the implementation of a bill that we passed last session, which was House Bill 3207, and that bill actually involves job veterans preferences during job interviews in public entities. There's been some implementation problems with that between various state bureaucracies, and at this point, the chair and I have had a discussion at distance, and what we're doing is asking Boley to take the lead in on behalf of both chambers to organize and lead stakeholder meetings on 24 interim legislation to resolve that veterans preference bill that we passed. They're supposed to make those recommendations by November 1st, so Boley has the lead. I know DAS will be involved in that, ODVA. I'm looking back there, so somebody nods their head that they know what I'm talking about. League of Oregon Cities, Association of Oregon Counties, veterans coaches and vocational counselors, and then legislative council is providing assets to that as our committee staff. And so we appreciate Boley taking that lead, and should any of the agencies be doubtful, the chair and I would be happy to pen a letter with the presiding officers, but I don't think that's necessary. So with that, colleagues, the purpose of today's meeting, I think we all know that we have a fairly new crew of soldiers and airmen in the National Guard, and we're trying to take some time, 1 hour today, to go through so that we, as the policy members, and you'll see that we have at the dais Legislative Council and LFO, Legislative Fiscal Office representatives, so that we understand how the Guard in Oregon works at the state level and how it's funded, how it works at the state federal level, how it's funded and how it proceeds, and how it works at the federal level. And so the chairs and I gave very specific instructions, no death by PowerPoint, and no PowerPoint rangers are allowed. I don't see any ranger tabs, so we'll probably be safe. And so they have promised us it would take them approximately an hour to go through. We're very informal, I think, you know, on the Senate side. So if anybody has a question or any of the staff has a question, now's the time to answer it. And with that, we greatly appreciate the Guard coming forward. Hopefully the technology is going to work on that screen here momentarily. And General Hokanson, I'm assuming you're going to lead, right?
Yes, sir.
Well, then jump in.
Chair Boquist, Vice Chair Mona Sanderson, Vice Chair Parrish, Senator Olson, Representative Boone, Representative Huffman, and Representative Esquivel. For the record, I'm Dan Hokanson, the Adjutant General for the State of Oregon. I want to thank you for the opportunity to meet with you today to provide both the Senate Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness and the House Committee on Veterans Services and Emergency Preparedness information about the Oregon Military Department. Although we only have time to provide a glimpse into our organization today, we have tried our best to cover the topics requested. I hope this will be part of an ongoing effort where you will be able to join us in the future, not only here at the Capitol, but also in the field, to learn about the outstanding work being done by the men and women who serve our state and nation in the Oregon Military Department. Before we begin, I'd like to briefly highlight two outstanding members of the Oregon Military Department. On the left is Captain John Mark Nelson. John Mark graduated from the Oregon State University and deployed shortly afterwards to Afghanistan. 2 years later, he deployed to Iraq before taking company command. He recently volunteered for an assignment with the National Guard Bureau's Strategic Plans and Policy Division in the Pentagon before being personally selected by the Chief of National Guard Bureau to be his aide. General Frank Grass, the highest-ranking National Guard officer and a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, selected Captain Nelson over all other majors for what's considered to be the most important major's position in the National Guard. He recently stated Captain Nelson is the best captain he has ever served with in over 40 years of military service. On the right is Oregon Air National Guard Technical Sergeant Doug Matthews. Doug was attending the University of Colorado when he left school to deploy with the 125th Special Tactics Squadron in Portland in the fall of 2012. In Afghanistan, his convoy was ambushed and his personal vehicle was hit by an improvised explosive device. After being thrown from his vehicle, he regained composure, took accountability of those in his vehicle, and pulled his wounded team leader out of the line of fire. Over the next several hours, his team faced effective fire from a numerically superior force. With over half of his team injured or wounded, Tech Sergeant Matthews directed airstrikes from multiple aircraft overhead and coordinated the medical evacuation of all wounded. Although wounded himself, he refused medical care until returned to his forward operating base, where he was quickly medically evacuated to Germany. Doug was credited with saving the lives of 6 teammates and killing 6 enemy insurgents. He has since made a full recovery, is back on status with his unit, and back in college. For his actions, Technical Sergeant Doug Matthews was recently awarded the Silver Star, our nation's third highest award for valor. So, those are some of the folks that we have in our formation every day. This morning, I'm accompanied by 5 colleagues who will provide specific details to the areas requested for our time today. In the order of their presentations, they are State Command Chief Master Sergeant Patrick Gauntz and Chief Master Sergeant Elena Cole, who will cover our dual missions, Mr. Carl Jorgensen, Director of State Financial Administration, who will cover our state funding, Colonel Bill Schutz, our United States Property and Fiscal Officer, who will cover our federal funding, and Major Brian Leibel, our Joint Forces Headquarters Staff Judge Advocate, who will cover authorities and oversight. I will begin with a brief snapshot of our organization, outline our strategic planning system, how we are organized, and the roles of the Adjutant Generals across our 54 states and territories. Next slide, please. As you can see from this map, we're a community-based force, and our 9,074 employees, of which only 20% are full-time, operate throughout our state. Our federal budget is $776 million per biennium, and our state budget is $417 million. We have 50 facilities encompassing 4.5 million square feet, and federal assets valued at just over $3 billion. If you look at the map here, Kingsley Field in southern Oregon and Klamath Falls, all F-15 pilots in the United States are trained at Kingsley Field, whether they're active duty, reserve, or National Guard. So that's one great capability that we have here within the state of Oregon. Next slide, please. Okay. The strategic direction of our organization has been under development since August, and the Oregon National Guard strategic planning system was implemented in December. Our system, as you can see, is composed of 3 documents. The first was the initial strategic direction letter, which is basically a 1-page document that establishes our vision, mission, and priorities. The second is the strategic direction to the Oregon National Guard, which is about 10 to 12 pages, which will provide greater detail to the strategic letter's priorities by identifying our key efforts as we move forward. The third document is the Oregon National Guard strategic plan, about a 25-page document, which will build on our strategic direction, reconcile ends, ways, and means, and establish measurable metrics to meet our goals and objectives for the next 5 years. The timeline for completion of the initial strategic letter was the 1st of December, and that has been completed. The initial draft of our strategic direction to the Oregon National Guard is due on the 1st of April, and the initial strategic plan is due on the 1st of January in 2015. Because our environment, as we see today, is currently and constantly changing, our letters will be updated every year or as required if the situation changes around the world or within our state. Our strategic plan, because of its size, will be updated every 2 years or as necessary based on how the situation changes. Next slide, please. As identified in our initial strategic direction, this is our mission statement. That the Oregon National Guard provides the state of Oregon and the United States with a ready force of citizen soldiers, airmen, and civilians trained and equipped to respond to any contingency, both natural or man-made. Next slide, please. Our resulting priorities, as outlined in our strategic letter, are to provide trained and ready operational forces to our state and nation, be effective stewards of our resources, sustain the Oregon National Guard community, and forge and maintain partnerships. To give you a preview of our upcoming strategic direction, I'd like to highlight just a couple of our key efforts that fall under these priorities. Under provide trained and ready forces, our first one is to maintain the ready force for our wartime missions and be prepared for likely domestic events. Number two is to maintain the best force structure for our state and nation. Number three is to retain and recruit our state and nation's best service members. And four, to develop and exercise a Cascadia playbook, which we are currently developing. As a side note, this is one of our highest priorities and has been in development in conjunction with the Office of Emergency Management since August. This is actually a copy of our most current version that we're working with the governor's staff and other agencies on. In short, it forms the base document for all the tasks that we can expect to execute here within the state. I've also spoken with California, Washington, and Alaska, and this will form the foundation for a regional response plan in the case that we have a Cascadian fault event anytime in the future. Our concern is it could happen any day, and so we want to have a plan to start with at any moment. Under our second priority of being effective stewards of our resources, some of our key efforts include the first, enhance accountability at both the state and federal level so we are auditable at any time. As a transparent organization, we owe that to our state and to our nation. The second is to maintain our equipment in our facilities. And the third is to leverage our net zero efforts. A side note, Oregon is the only National Guard state in the nation to be selected by the Army to be part of its net zero program. Our goals for this program are to reduce our energy consumption based on 2003 levels by over 50%, educate our employees to reduce usage by an additional 15%, and develop opportunities to end up producing 35% of our energy use. So that's something we're fully vested in and continue to work on day to day. Under our third priority of sustaining the Oregon National Guard community, some of our efforts include taking care of our employees and our families, do everything we can to reduce suicides, for which we appreciate the opportunity we were given last year to highlight our efforts here in the Capitol. Three, to do everything we can to eliminate sexual assault and sexual harassment. Four, to effectively manage our employees. Five, strengthen our community relationships. Six, embrace a culture of total fitness. And seven, to maintain our connection with our veterans. Lastly, under the fourth priority of forge and maintain partnerships, some of our key efforts are, first, to develop our relationships with our state partners and state agencies. Second, develop our relationships with our federal partners. Third, leverage our relationship with the Office of Emergency Management. Four, leverage our counter-drug program. And five, continue to develop and grow our state partnerships with Vietnam and Bangladesh. One key element I would like to personally relay to each of you that is integral throughout our strategic planning process and is a guiding fundamental principle to our entire organization is fostering an environment of transparency in everything that we do and doing what is right for our state and for our nation. Next slide. Transitioning to how we are organized, this slide depicts our current organizational structure. Although it's busy and potentially confusing, it's a result of trying to adapt an older org structure to an environment that has changed rapidly over the last 12 years. Next slide, please. This slide depicts our proposed organizational structure we will transition to in the upcoming months. It's based on a thorough review of our organization since I arrived, incorporating lessons learned, force structure changes, and proposed organizational changes in Joint Forces Headquarters. It's a much flatter organization that is more responsive, helps clarify responsibility, better prepares us to respond to domestic emergencies, and fosters the development of future leaders through increased responsibilities and opportunities. Next slide, please. Lastly, I would like to briefly address the roles of adjutant generals across the 54 states and territories. As you can see by this chart, Oregon is one of only 12 states where the adjutant general is responsible for emergency management and the Homeland Security Advisor to the governor. Not depicted here is the fact that virtually every state is organized differently due to its force structure of Army and Air Forces, the natural disasters it faces, and its historical roles and missions. I am in constant contact with the adjutant generals across the nation and regularly consult with them on the latest lessons learned and improvements that make sense to adapt in Oregon. Fortunately, Oregon is one of those states that many other adjutant generals come to based on the skill set and reputation of our soldiers and airmen, and so we share a lot of what we learn here in Oregon with the other states. With respect to how we are organized compared to other state agencies, we're still in the process of looking at agencies within the state that we could learn from to gain efficiencies from based on how they are organized and how they are led. We certainly don't have everything right, and if somebody else has got it better, we're certainly willing to learn. Unless there's any specific questions for me at this time, I'll be followed by State Command Master Chief Sergeant Patrick Gons and Chief Master Sergeant Elena Cole, who will cover our dual missions. We look forward to your questions and dialogue.
Questions, members? Oh, please.
Okay. Chief?
Now we're going to get the real story, right?
It's
got
yes,
the
sir.
Enlisted people up here.
Good afternoon, Chair Boquist and the members of the committee. For the record, I'm Chief Master Sergeant Patrick Gons, the Oregon Air National Guard State Command Chief. Next slide. As we look at this slide, we see how the Oregon National Guard wears two hats. It's comprised of the Army National Guard, and it's comprised of the Air National Guard. We are a dual mission force, both Air and Army. Our federal mission is to provide trained units available for active duty in the time of war or national emergency. Our state mission is to provide military support to civil authorities and respond to state emergencies. Under Title 10, troops are federally funded for missions overseen by the President. Under Title 32, troops are funded by their respective states for missions overseen by the state governors. As part of this unique aspect, the National Guard is the first military responder for requirements within the United States borders, whether homeland security, natural disaster, or other threats. Each governor can immediately mobilize state assets to meet their needs or those of a neighboring state and utilize them prior to or during the submission of a request for federal assistance. The Guard's dual mission requires a disciplined balance between persistent readiness to defend threats to our nation and its vital interest, and a constant availability to help our communities and states. In the upper right-hand corner, you'll see Oregon Army National Guard soldiers of the Forward Support Medical Evacuation Team, Charlie Company, 7158 Aviation, here in Salem. They're supporting a medical evacuation mission during the deployment to Camp Bonsteel, Kosovo. In the lower left-hand corner, an Army Oregon Air National Guard HH-60M Black Hawk helicopter from, again, Charlie Company, 7158 Aviation, lifts off from a makeshift landing zone near Crooked River Ranch on September 22, 2012. The crew responded to the request for assistance from Deschutes County authorities to help rescue a Redmond man stranded at Crooked River Canyon. Next slide. Here we see other examples of the Army National Guard being globally employed and being first military responders. A soldier in the upper right-hand corner, a soldier with the Oregon Army National Guard, the 162nd Engineering Company, which is attached to the 2nd Combat Engineering Battalion of the United States Marine Corps, aims his rifle next to mine-resistant ambush-protected armored vehicle, which is an MRAP, which you probably have all heard about. During a route clearance mission across the desert of Homeland province in southern Afghanistan, March of 2010. In the lower corner, we see Oregon Army National Guard soldiers join civilian volunteers in shoring up the levee with sandbags, known as the Last Stand Levee. This is north of Burns, Oregon, in April of 2011. These are examples of the Army National Guard mission, and Chief Cole, just to the right of me, will give you examples of the Air National Guard.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Chief Master Sergeant Elena Cole. I'm the Military Personnel Management Officer for the Oregon Air National Guard. Of the Oregon Air Guard, the 142nd Fighter Wing out of Portland provides an airspace control alert on a 24/7 basis. The picture to your top right shows the Oregon Air National Guard's 142nd Fighter Wing's F-15 taking off for an alert scramble training mission. Other missions include our response to 9/11, Operation Noble Eagle, and Operation Enduring Freedom.
And Chair Book, was just a point to highlight with the upper right. When we talk about our air control alert mission with the F-15's takeoff, I'm not sure if any of you are aware, but on July 4th in 2012, the Russian military sent a bear bomber, the closest it had been to the United States, continental United States, in over 50 years. And it was our F-15s out of Portland that actually intercepted that bomber off the coast of California and tracked it just outside our air defense identification zone until the aircraft turned back north. So it is a relevant mission, and I would tell you that having served at NORAD headquarters, our unit in Portland routinely is the number one rated air control alert squadron in the United States Air Force. So continue.
As a first responder, the Oregon Air National Guard's 125th Special Tactics Squadron provides a search and rescue mission during the Vernonia floods. On the slide to your bottom left shows a young girl pointing to her family sitting on top of their house, desperately in need of being rescued. Other missions include forest fires, tornadoes, and hurricanes. On average, the Oregon National Guard responds to 300 state emergencies in a year since 1949. In addition, the 173rd Fighter Wing in Southern Oregon is the sole training base for F-15 pilots in the nation. Next slide, please. The Oregon National Guard continues to support this state and nation. This slide depicts over 4,600 guardsmen have been mobilized for state active duty, and over 18,000 have been activated in support of federal active duty since 2001. I will now be followed by Mr. Carl Jorgensen and Colonel William Schutz.
Thank you. General Hokins, if you can ever figure out how to fix the communications and the radios in Vernonia, it'd be helpful. We've only been there three times for the same reason.
Chair Boquist, I need to bring you by the 125th Special Tactics Squadron. Some of the equipment they have now is what we dreamed of 10 years ago.
Well, we've been surviving for three decades on ham radio operators, I think, as you know, and helicopters. So.
Good afternoon, Chair Boquist, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. I'm Carl Jorgensen, the Director of Financial Administration. The majority of our functional programs are operated through state plans with the Federal National Guard Bureau, referred to as cooperative agreements. These cooperative agreements are either fully funded by federal dollars or require some degree of state matching funds, depending on the programs. The cooperative agreements are contractual arrangements wherein the state administers the programs to include employees, procurement, and service delivery. The state seeks reimbursement of its cost at the agreed-upon federal participation. Next slide. The Oregon Military Department's 2013-15 legislative adopted budget is 5% general fund, 27% other funds, and 68% federal funds. However, when the direct federal appropriation for National Guard personnel, training, and their equipment are included in the overall macro view, the percentages for the entire organization are 87% federal funds, 11% other funds, and 2% general fund. Next slide. The Oregon Military Department's 2013-15 legislative adopted budget is executed across 7 budget program areas. The entire general fund is appropriated by the Oregon legislature, who also approves the expenditure limitation for other funds and federal funds. Other than the FEMA grants that flow through the Office of Emergency Management, federal funds arrive in the budget through cooperative agreements between the agency and the National Guard Bureau. Next slide. The next 3 slides will show the major programs of cooperative agreements entered into by the National Guard Bureau, the grantor, and the Oregon Military Department, the grantee. A more detailed description of the cooperative agreement programs was provided in response to a budget note during the February 2012 legislative session. Cooperative agreements are funded through Department of Defense appropriations provided by the National Guard Bureau for Army and Air National Guard construction, minor construction, maintenance, repair, or operations of facilities and mission operational support. And for other programs authorized by Congress or Department of Defense to be performed by grantees in support of the National Guard. The majority of our cooperative agreements are appendices of a master cooperative agreement for operations and maintenance. Military construction cooperative agreements are entered into for major military construction projects. We currently operate 2 standalone or special military project cooperative agreements for the equipment refurbishment program at Camp Withycom and the dining operations at Camp Rylea. The Oregon Youth Challenge Program in Bend and the Starbase programs located at each airbase are 2 youth cooperative agreements. We award and administer about 185 contractual arrangements annually. Pending any questions, I will be followed by Colonel Schutz.
Jump in, Colonel.
Good afternoon, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Colonel Bill Schutz, and I'm the United States Property and Fiscal Officer for Oregon. The USPFO is the sole federal agent in each state territory responsible directly to the Chief of National Guard Bureau to receive and account for all federal funds and property issued to the National Guard and to ensure that all federal laws, regulations, policies, and procedures are adhered to relative to those federal resources. Next slide. Federal statute that authorizes the USPFO is Title 32 U.S. Code, Section 708. As you can see, there are some additional authorities as well. Next slide. The principal responsibilities of the USPFO include accountable officer for funds and property, as already noted, but also includes operating logistics and supply support systems, mobilization and transition support, and to maintain the database of record. These responsibilities are managed through the performance of the USPFO organization. Next slide. There's a picture of our organization. We have about 79 authorized soldiers and airmen in our organization.
Colonel, how many are filled? You said authorized. I recognize it.
Sir, all of them. Actually, not all of them are filled. We have a couple that are announcements are out. Mm-hmm. But we generally have them filled most of the time. So, and again, they're Air and Army, so that's a joint organization.
That's why purple, yeah.
Yes, sir.
I spent too long in purple. I know that.
Too long in purple?
Too long in purple.
Next slide. This slide depicts the flow of federal funds and property to each of the states. Funds and property are first appropriated through the service secretaries, both Army and Air, to the Chief of the National Guard Bureau. The Chief transfers through his staff to the USPFO, who will accept and then transfer to the appropriate Army and Air National Guard federal organizations. Next slide. The next several slides will show the federal funds that annually come into the state and will also show our current inventory and value as of the end of our fiscal year 13. That's 30 September. For the Army National Guard, these are the major categories of funding. Next slide.
Question, if you back up. Could you just skim down through the acronyms?
Yes, sir, I can.
I know somebody, the chief was thinking that, you know, we should all know the acronyms, and he was spelling it out. You know, we probably have seen MRAP, but I'm not sure people know some of the other acronyms that are up there.
I'd be happy to, Chair Boquist. Okay, so on the account side, the QB, the QF, those are just internal accounting codes, so they don't really mean much. They just identify, for instance, HRO, Human Resources Office, the J4s are logistics. Our CFMO is our Construction and Facilities Management Office, our officer. Of course, aviation, RRB, is recruiting and retention, and then our J3 is our operations. And then for the purpose, it just details it a little bit further.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Next slide. G1, personnel, and then the J8 is my office, the USPFO. J6 is our signal or IT personnel, environmental for ENV, and then CNPO is our counter drug program. And again, this is the Army side, so it's over $175 million in fiscal year 13 for the Army. This is our inventory as of the end of FY13, depicted in major categories, again, for the Army National Guard. I'll let you look at that for a second, but there's over, as noted, over $1 billion in inventory.
Mr. Chair. Please, question here.
Sir, these inventories that you have on track here, are these new vehicles, used vehicles, or a mix of both, or have they come back from the war zone?
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, these are all the vehicles, so they can be new coming in. Most of this did not go to war, so they weren't in either the Iraqi war or Afghanistan war.
Okay, thank you.
I'll follow up with a question, though, if you don't know the answer. I'm sure the Adjutant General will, because he's wearing wings. How many aircraft do we have left, and how many do we have on station in Oregon, non-deployed? Fire question is what it is.
Chair Boquist, at this time, we have 12 of the HH-60s here in Salem. We've got 4 of the UH-72 Lakotas, and our Chinooks that are in Pendleton, we just had to turn one in that was basically transferred to us from an active duty unit. The aircraft is unflyable and unrepairable. So we've just got our 6th one. So we have 6 of our Chinooks out in Pendleton, but we're doing everything we can to make sure that they're all flyable. And of course, as you know, the availability, we have aircraft in maintenance at all time. Mm-hmm. But currently at this time, we're at our full complement.
Follow-up question. The Lakota, is that the one that they're trying to take away?
Chair Boquist, yes, sir.
Okay.
That's and I can cover a separate conversation on that,
right,
being the committee head of that in dealing with the Army.
So, right.
But I think at this time it appears that that has been removed and that the Army will not take those aircraft.
Can't trust the acting component. Senator Olson, question.
These of the 6 heavy lift helicopters you have in Pendleton, how many are actually right now can fly?
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, I would have to, as it changes daily, I will need to get that. The last time I checked, they had 3 that were flyable, 2 that would be shortly ready, and 1 that was long-term repair. But I will get that exact answer for you afterwards.
The reason I ask that, in our resilience committee, we talk about heavy lift capacity if we have an emergency, and I was just curious to find out how many we could bring online instantly.
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, that is obviously a big concern of ours as well. One of the things we face is the aircraft we have are D-model Chinooks. The Army is going to the F model. In fiscal year 16, we will actually turn in our aircraft and receive the latest up-to-date aircraft. Unfortunately, when we deployed, some of our aircraft stay downrange and we're backfilled. And unfortunately, when people turn in aircraft, they don't turn in their best. And thank goodness we have some of the best mechanics in the National Guard writ large, so they can get just about anything flying. It just takes a little bit of time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, sir. Next slide. So federal funding for the Portland National Guard base. Again, major funding categories. You see the military pay, military personnel. O&M is operation and maintenance. And again, you can look over to the purpose, and it details a little bit of what the operation and maintenance performs. Next slide. O&M, again, as the account number, and then on the purpose side, you'll see ACA, that's the Airspace Control Alert Mission. IT and SURF-P. That one's a good one. It's chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, and high yield explosives, and that takes care of the C part of it. Enhanced Response Force Package is what SURF-P means. And then, of course, the State Partnership Program for over $112 million.
Question here from the representative.
I like this being able to just cut in. Do any of you know, I've just recently heard that the federal budget is, they're talking about in Congress of cutting the military pay, and I just wondered if you could address that, how that would affect us here.
Chair Boquist, Representative Boone. Currently, the latest I saw was that they were going to freeze the pay of all general officers, but they would do a 1% pay raise for all other members. And that's what I believe the Secretary of Defense stated Tuesday evening when he did his last briefing.
So and I missed the briefing, so thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah.
Any more questions? Next slide.
Any questions?
This depicts the federal equipment on hand, again, in major categories for the Portland Air National Guard base. Our largest, of course, are our weapon systems, the F-15 Eagles. Over $1 billion of inventory.
Chair Boquist, just one point here is when we look at our contingency of F-15 aircraft, there's a very unique capability in the version 3 radar. Most of our F-15s are the version 0. We're working really hard at the national level to get all of our aircraft upgraded to the version 3. And just to give you the background, the lifetime of an F-15 Eagle is about 18,000 hours, whereas the new F-35 Strike Fighter is about 8,000 hours. And so if we can get the upgraded version radar, our aircraft, the F-35 will come into service and leave service, and the F-15E will still be flying. So it's very important to, obviously, us here in Oregon with our air control alert mission in Portland and then also our F-15 training down in Klamath Falls.
Nice to know they're doing smart decisions in Washington, D.C.
Chair Boquist, just as a point, for the cost of one F-35, we could upgrade the entire fleet of F-15 aircraft.
Yeah, I know. That's my point exactly. For the cost of one of those, we could fix a lot of domestic problems, too, and we could have twice as many F-15s.
Yes, sir.
To intercept bear bombers that they do not. So.
This slide depicts the funding for Kingsley Air National Guard Base in Klamath Falls.
I have a Kingsley question, if someone can answer it. I'll try it. I was surprised. We had another hearing unrelated to this, but related to veterans, and it was very interesting because there was a staff sergeant from Joint Base Lewis McChord,
mm-hmm.
Who actually had been assigned somehow down at Kingsley, and it was one of his children. It was the poster child for the educational compact, and I was trying to figure out, I mean, we didn't raise it then because he was giving us a very problematic story because he'd been transferred down there, I'm assuming TDY or long-term from Base McChord. So at Kingsley, is there a handful of active component Army personnel there too in base support besides Guard personnel?
Chair Boquist, we do have one of our cavalry troops is stationed on Kingsley Field,
okay.
And so we do have a small contingency there. One thing is the Air Force is actually adding additional full-time active duty personnel to Kingsley Field as they're growing the number of pilots that they're training there.
Thank you.
Next slide. Once again, federal equipment on hand at the Kingsley Air National Guard Base, and once again, our F-15s is our major weapon systems.
Are those training-only aircraft, or are those up-armed?
Chair Boquist, they are training aircraft, but there is a move to have active weapons actually there in case they need them on a short notice.
A follow-up? Follow-up here to my right.
Sir, when you say a movement, can you put a parameters, a time frame on that, or is just we're talking about it?
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, having spent some time at NORAD, when we look at the inventory requirements for some of the threats that we face, there's a shortage. I can probably just leave it at that.
Okay.
And so most of those go to the more units that are technically assigned that mission. But they understand that in a major event that they're going to need virtually every aircraft everywhere. And so that's one of the things. I can get you the status of where we are with Kingsley Field. They did show me the statistics of where they were, but that's dated by about 3 months.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Okay. As you can see, again, $1 billion at Kingsley of inventory. Next slide. Now to contracting. The authority to issue federal contracts flows from the Secretary of the Army to the head of the contracting agency. In our case, the head of the contracting agency is the Chief of National Guard Bureau. Chief of National Guard Bureau has delegated contracting authority to the PARC, who is the principal assistant responsible for contracting, again, at National Guard Bureau. While the USPFO has contracting oversight responsibilities, actual contracting authority is passed on to warranted federal contracting officers in the USPFO office and the base contracting offices. They are guided by the Federal Acquisition Regulation and any additional service supplements. Next slide. These are just some examples or some data on our contracting actions and dollar values expended throughout the purchasing and contracting offices, both in my office and at the base. Some examples, again, include food for our drills, fuel for our jets. I think you saw a pretty large bill in some of those spreadsheets on fuel bills. We do purchase sandbags, especially in this season, but we purchase them because they are available to us as a federal requirement for enhancing our foxholes or enhancing command and control cells during our field exercises.
We need a lot of sandbags in this building right now.
We also have the contracting authority for design and construction contracting for both bases, and we contracted for over $7 million worth this year. We expect that that activity will increase at Pang because we just recently signed a new lease there. Next slide. The Oregon National Guard adds value to Oregon. I've talked about the millions of dollars that come in annually and billions of dollars in equipment inventory that we currently have in Oregon. And in your handouts, you will note 2 years of economic impact to each of the Oregon counties. Next slide. Our program and activities are examined and evaluated regularly under the principles of stewardship and accountability for the use of public resources. As noted, the organizations receive annually over 100 audits, reviews, inspections, monitoring visits from various external and internal activities. The next couple slides are just but a sample of some of these activities. Next slide. The X's, for your information, depict the frequency of these activities. Next slide. Thank you. If there are any questions, be happy to answer them.
Question? I have a practical question so everybody recognizes faces here. Practically, we have cooperative master agreement and then we have master agreements or that sort of deal. In practicality, you represent the National Guard Bureau and you sign on behalf of the federal government, and the good general here as a state employee signs on behalf of the state of Oregon. Is that in simple terms, that's
Chair Boquist, that's exactly correct, yes.
Right. Okay. When he's not drawing that pays, it's going to be cut.
Other questions? We move on.
All right. Thank you. I'll be followed by Major Brian Leibel.
Good afternoon, Chair Boquist, members of the Joint Committee. I'm Major Brian Lible, Staff Judge Advocate for the Joint Force Headquarters, Oregon National Guard. Throughout this presentation, we've discussed the state and federal missions of the Oregon Military Department and its components. The state legislature, Congress, and the Department of Defense provides guidance for training for and the conducting of these missions. State statutes and regulations provide the primary guidance for Oregon Military Department's state missions, while federal law, regulations, and case law does the same with the federal missions. With these two bodies of authority, are the basis for the agency's legal authorities. But before I discuss them, I want to provide some additional context. Next slide. Here's a matrix that shows three different duty statuses of a National Guardsman, and which are the three right columns. The left column are the various descriptors of each status. State active duty is for the state missions under the control of the governor and the adjutant general, and mainly used for, of course, for emergencies and natural disasters that we do within the state. Title 32, United States Code, is for the National Guard training and homeland defense, and this also includes our drill weekends and annual training. And also, this is what also funded the airport security after 9/11. Although federal money is used, Oregon National Guard remains under the control of the governor. Title 10, United States Code, applies when the Oregon National Guard is called to federal service as a reserve of the armed forces. Oregon National Guard is in the service of the United States under the command and control of the President and Department of Defense. Next slide. Now we'll go back to the legal authorities. Starting with the state authority, these Oregon Revised Statutes chapters are the foundation of the Oregon Military Department. For example, 396.125 states that the governor is commander-in-chief of the organized militia. 396.305 outlines the Oregon Military Department's duties and functions, while 315 states that the Adjutant General is the director of the Oregon Military Department. 398 contains provisions of the State Military Justice Code, while 399 provides for the ordering of service members to state active duty and lists their rights, privileges, and protections in any duty status. Chapter 401 states the responsibilities of the Oregon Emergency Management, while 402 outlines the process through which Oregon can either provide or receive assistance from another state in times of emergency. More detailed guidance comes from in the form of military regulation. ORS 396.125 allows the governor to promulgate military regulations, and that authority has been delegated to the Adjutant General. State military regulations provide instruction in the areas of personnel, operations, logistics, finance, and good order and discipline. Oregon administrative rules are also used, such as Chapter 104, which covers the functional areas of OEM. There's little to no state case law that affects OMD's functions and operations. Next slide. As I mentioned, much of what, when, where, and how the Oregon National Guard trains and fulfills its federal mission is laid out in 32 U.S.C., 10 U.S.C., and military regulations. Title 32 provides for military schools, training, and operational support for the Oregon National Guard's federal mission. It also funds our full-time federal technicians and our full-time service members in uniform. It also outlines the National Guard training requirements and covers the duties and responsibilities of various positions, such as the Adjutant General and the United States the Property and Fiscal Officer. Title 10 USC provides for the U.S. Armed Forces, both active and reserve component, covering federal missions and overseas training. DOD gives specific instructions on the U.S. Armed Forces in the form of regulation, whether the proponent is DOD itself, the Army, the Air Force, or National Guard Bureau. Federal civil regulations also apply, such as government ethics and federal acquisition regulation. Further, federal case law provides instruction on a number of issues that affect either military service or the military itself. Next slide, thank you. As with any agency or unit of government, the Oregon Military Department receives, processes, delivers, and stores a vast amount of information. Some of it is protected for a variety of reasons, whether it's classified, for official use only, or receives some other categorical protection by law. Listed here are some of the more prominent statutory protections of information that the Oregon Military Department follows. Next slide. Because of the dual missions, the duties and functions of the Oregon Military Department and its components can be overseen by the three branches of government at both levels, state and federal. The state legislature controls OMD's state budget. The governor is commander-in-chief of the state militia and appoints the adjutant general, who is both the director of the Oregon Military Department and the head of the Oregon National Guard. The legislature, by law, provides for the organization, maintenance, and discipline of the Oregon Military Department. And you have done so in the ORS chapters 396, 398, 399, and 401. For the federal mission, Congress and the executive branch, namely the Department of Defense, oversee the money, equipment, and training of the U.S. Armed Forces. Congress is responsible for the size and support of the military and appropriates money for the same. Earlier, the USPFO for Oregon described the oversight that is built in to the appropriation process in terms of audit, the hierarchy, and also the Government Accountability Office, which reports back to Congress. Congress also equips and sets training and military standards for the state militia, with reports provided from the National Guard back to Congress and the executive branch. That concludes my portion of the presentation. I'll be followed by Major General Hokanson with some additional notes.
Not so quick, Major. Just for clarification for the people who are here, you're a state employee, Title 10, Title 32.
I'm a Senator Boquist. I'm a Title 32 service member.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Appreciate it. Thank you very much, Major.
Chair Boquist, I just wanted to provide two brief slides just to kind of update the committee on a couple of things that I think you would want to be aware of. Next slide, please. The first one, the map of the world currently shows the number of service members we have deployed either here at CONUS or overseas on a day-to-day basis, and this is a snapshot of today. If you look at the chart at the top, I just wanted to make you aware of some of the upcoming deployments that we have this year. The first two are the 142nd Fighter Wing out of Portland. They're a civil engineering squadron. They'll be going to Afghanistan, a total of 28 personnel. They'll be mobilizing in April and May. But unlike the Army, they won't go to mobilizations training. They'll do their training here and go direct. With the 234th Engineers, they're based out of Warrenton, Oregon, engineering company. They're scheduled to go to Kuwait, potentially Afghanistan. We're still waiting for clarification, and that affects 164 of our soldiers. Next, we have the 142nd Fighter Wing Security Forces Squadron. That's a group of six personnel that are scheduled to go provide air base support in Afghanistan. And lastly, our biggest one, we have three battalion size elements. The one of the 186 Infantry, headquartered in Ashland, Oregon. The two of the 162 Infantry, headquartered in Springfield, and 182 Cav in Bend. Those three battalions are scheduled to deploy later this summer. That's just for a total of, right now, 1,031 personnel. But as you know, we still are trying to get a security agreement signed with President Karzai. That may or may not affect this. We're continuing to train as if we're going to go, but we'll find out how that matures between now and then. I believe the Afghan elections are in April. They think the earliest results they will get is in June, but they're anticipating September before they know who the new president would be and whether or not he's willing to sign the Security Forces Agreement.
Good question on that, General. Is June the mobilization date and August the deployment date? Is that generally, or is it a window?
Chair Boquist, that's a window. Each of the battalions, they're not scheduled to go simultaneously. They'll be rotating based on the unit coming out of theater. So our earliest move date is June. Our last one is in August. And currently they're scheduled to go to Fort Hood, Texas for their pre-mobilization or post-mob before they go into theater.
And based on likelihoods, what's the pre-mobilization or the pre-mobilization training period? 30 days, 60 days, 90 days?
I don't know the exact date, Chair Boquist, but I can get that. Traditionally, it's been about 60 days, mm-hmm. and it's really mission dependent on what they're doing. Right now, they're mainly providing security as we contract our footprint there.
So what you're really saying is the likelihood of them deploying remains high because they will be there to turn the light switch out.
Chair Boquist, you're exactly right.
Which is exact most hostile time to be anyway. Just short of a Marine Corps beach landing.
Chair Boquist, that's why it is our top priority, is to make sure those folks are fully trained and equipped.
Mr. Chair. Sir, those units that are being deployed to Afghanistan, how many times have they been there already?
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, I would need to get the exact specifics. I know that two of the 162 was mobilized in 2004 and 5. They deployed again as well as 2009 and 10. So that particular unit, it'll be their third mobilization. If we look at the individual soldiers, some will be on their fourth or fifth deployment, and we'll have a large number that have never deployed. And because it's not the full brigade, we have the opportunity to actually offer opportunities to deploy for soldiers in other units that have not deployed. And for those that have deployed multiple times and would like to sit this one out, we have that opportunity. In addition, we have a training, actually, as the 41st Brigade Combat Team, it's going to grow another battalion. They're going to add a maneuver battalion. That unit is the first of the 200th Infantry out of New Mexico. And their Adjutant General, Brigadier General Salas, and I have been communicating, and we're actually offering opportunities for them to provide an entire platoon to deploy with us, as well as some of our staff officers, so that we'll they'll be integrated directly into our formations.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Next slide, please. Chair Boquist, as alluded to earlier, I just wanted to give the committee a brief update, having returned from Washington, D.C. Last night, where we are with the federal budget negotiations. The Secretary of Defense rolled out his budget, and the Army at this time is programming on $335,000 for the National Guard. We're over $350,000 right now. If we go to that level, Oregon's piece of the pie is we would lose 323 soldiers out of our formation, which is about 5%. If the Budget Control Act remains law and it goes down to 315,000, we will lose a total of 640 soldiers, or about 10% of our organization. In addition to that, there's the Army Aviation Restructuring Initiative, which looks to pull all attack aircraft out of the National Guard, which is 192 of our AH-64s. If that goes through the state of Oregon, one of the small but most capable states could lose up to three of our aircraft, which you know the impact of that during fire season and with our search and rescue mission, as well as our federal mission. So I've been involved with some of the senior committees on that, providing the latest updates. I've been keeping the governor's staff advised, as well as our legislative teams, and I will continue to provide updates to the committee as requested as we go through. I believe the budget is supposed to be brought out on the 4th of March, and we'll know more at that point. However, our congressional delegation and the Council of Governors have voiced very clearly their opposition to this, and they would like to see the National Guard stay at the strength that it is. So any support we can get from within the state is greatly appreciated.
Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You have a question, Representative?
What's our best way to support you in that? I mean,
Chair Boquist, Representative Boone, primarily through our U.S. representatives and U.S. senators and the governor, as they will actually be voting on that. In the very near future.
Thank you.
Other questions? Two things jump up that are of concern. Obviously, none of us can have an impact, but except when they come back, and that's more of our responsibility other than the liabilities every time you sign something on our behalf. But having said that, the challenge is, I mean, I was there the first time around. there were people sitting in this room that were there too, and they took our battalions and carved them up and handed them out, and there was no command and control, and they came back not only broken in equipment, but they came back broken in people. And that likelihood is, that your slide there shows a whole likelihood. You're not sending a command and control element. The newspaper, which we don't have to quote here, shows where they're going. It sure looks like they're going to get chopped up into smaller units and smaller pieces, and they won't have support, and they won't have equipment.
Chair Boquist, the thing that we're really working on is when they remove the brigade headquarters, we are really working to make sure that the battalions stay as a formation and that the individual companies report directly to the battalion within their area of responsibility. We're working directly now with the units that are currently executing the mission in Afghanistan, and as far as we can see right now, unless there's a significant change, our battalions will be working with our companies. And having deployed with a brigade in 2009 and 10, we started a year early to make sure that we were able to make that happen for our deployment, and we are doing everything we can to make sure that Oregon soldiers work for Oregon leaders. And we deploy as a unit, and we come home as a unit.
Any other questions or comments? Staff, any? Your heads are spinning, right? Death by PowerPoint here. We're familiar with how this works.
Mr. Chair,
question.
We're not finished with the presentation yet, are we, General?
Chair Boquist, Representative Huffman, actually that completes, barring any questions, and I just had a final note, sir.
Well, I will finish my email to Congressman Walden as soon as I finish making some comments with your indulgence, hey, Mr. Chair.
We're easy on this committee, except on the military.
Thank you. First of all, General, I want to thank you for having your staff in the building and a number of our committee here, all of our committee hearings, answering questions. It's extremely helpful and beneficial. I look forward to the opening of the Dallas Readiness Center shortly, and really appreciate all of the effort. Even from some folks on the back row here many, many years ago that helped with design and all that stuff, and General Caldwell and everybody that went into that. One thing I want to put out a little heads up while I have a bunch of people in the room, higher education in the House is going to have a informational hearing during legislative days in May, and it's going to have an update from community colleges, Krista, ODVA, Cameron, and hopefully the National Guard, to kind of give an update on Senate Bill 275 that we passed in 2011, which directs community colleges, but the OUS system said they were doing it already, and that's when a veteran comes back into the state, they can go to a place of higher ed and get college credit for training and schooling. And so I'm trying to gather up information from all entities involved to see how that's actually working out in the real world. And finally, one thing that, you know, after seeing your deployment map and budgeting and everything that's going on, I know it's probably not the right time to ask, but I'm going to plant the seed. A number of years ago, probably 99 and 2000, under General Bergen, we did some what I call boss lifts on steroids, some trips to Europe, seeing some of the soldiers in training, and just a variety of mission involvement. And it was it changed my life. I had no idea I would be in this building back when we made those trips. But I think a number of your staff can tell you that my actions in this body were directly impacted by those trips, opening my eyes to what was going on, getting to know people, understanding the missions better. If there's any way we could ever get back to a point. Now, those were media-related. I was a broadcaster at the time and on the Oregon Association of Broadcasters, and that was my involvement. But as a member of the legislature, I think it would be extremely beneficial for certain members every couple of years or so to be able to do trips like that. So thank you, Mr. Chair. And General,
you want to comment first before I go to the next representative? Yes. You're not going to get off easy here.
Yes, sir. Senator Boquist, Representative Huffman, we will do everything we can, particularly with the upcoming deployment. Unfortunately, sequestration has caused regulations that have basically for lack of a better term, strangled our capability or even ability to request waivers. But I think it's absolutely critical, like you said, that our elected officials see what the men and women within their communities in our state are doing. And so we will do everything we can to try and support that.
You're second, unfortunately. Representative Parrish is next.
Thank you. General Hawkinson, what can we be doing for you post-deployment in terms of support? It's great while you're gone to, you know, people out having rallies and waving flags, but the fact is you're going to bring some of those 1,200 soldiers home, some of them from multiple deployments, and not an easy mission. So, you know, and they're going to have a whole slew of families back behind here at home. What are the things that we can be doing? I know that there's an emergency fund that tends to run out of funds. Certainly some of the family support groups don't get funding because of the way they've been set up through federal regulations. So what can those of us who are here as state legislators be doing to support the post-deployment piece when the last deployment, you know, 50% of those guys came home to no jobs, and the last time we heard in our House committee that 20% of that cohort was still unemployed. So curious what your thoughts are on that.
Senator Boquist, Representative Parrish, having been involved in the last one personally, one of the things that we're working very hard on is really, and the military across the board, is taking a look at all the various programs that they've had over the years when we had a large amount of funding. As the funding draws down, they're really looking for the most successful ones. One of those is what they call a strong bonds event, where we get the soldiers and their family members together to help them deal with the stress prior to deployment and then post-deployment as well. In terms of the emergency fund, we're still fairly good at that point. One of the things that I plan to do is during the deployment is be with a brigade commander to go to each of these communities and meet with the family members so we can get directly from them where they need the greatest help, so that we can kind of tailor it to that specific as opposed to broadly and make sure that we address those individuals. In terms of the family support groups, we're working very hard. There is a decrease in funding, but as a result, what we've done is recently I sat down with our entire J9 or the team that's responsible for family support and asked them if they had to start all over, how they would reorganize today. They gave me a plan, and we started executing that. We moved some of our family assistance to different areas they had not been to before, primarily Bend and Springfield, so they can service the families of the units that are going to be deploying in the Bend and the Southern Oregon areas. So, and we've also made a large investment with our Heroes to Hired program. In fact, I think we had over 300 soldiers, not only just within the Oregon Guard, soldiers and airmen, but also veterans hired at our last event in Portland. And so as we get closer, what I'd like to do is actually provide you specific areas where we could use support. And we'll get that feedback directly from the families. But I just that you're asking the question is greatly helpful at this point.
Do you have a follow-up question? Okay, so then we're going to go next to Representative Boone, and then we're going to go to Representative Witt.
Okay, and I just wanted to let you know, Major General, that I've requested our chair of Coastal Caucus to write a letter from all nine of us or eight of us or however many. We're about 10% of the legislature, but we're a strong bunch. And to our congressional delegation and request the support for full funding for you. So, and if you have any other pieces you want to go in, let me know.
Okay. Chair Boquist, Representative Boone, specifically, I think it's House Resolution 3930.
Okay.
And what that asks for is actually a commission to take a look at the size of the U.S. military and propose what they think is the best solution for our nation.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Witt, you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. General, thank you very, very much for your very fine and comprehensive presentation and that of everyone else that you've brought before us here today. I'm curious, it seems to me that a loss of 300 personnel potentially due to budget cuts would be would make such a severe impact that it would adversely impact your mission. A loss of 600 would seem to me to be devastating. Could you give us some indication of what we might expect given those that degree of loss of personnel?
Chair Boquist, Representative Witt, a point of clarification I should make clear is all these cuts are really associated with the Army. We're very fortunate with the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, General Welsh, has got an extremely good relationship with both the Air Guard and the Air Reserve, and so we do not see any significant cuts to the Air National Guard. In fact, we may see some growth in our Special Tactics Squadron or potential other missions, so we're very good off there. Particularly this applies to the Army. When you look at the 5% cut of 323, that's a large formation for us, which may cause us to reevaluate some of our armories and some of our smaller communities. I have always felt I did not want to be like the larger Army where we close all these bases and we all move into a large one. We lose contact with our community. And so my intent is to try and stay a part of our community, because when we mobilize and deploy, our entire state is with us. With that respect, as we look at the 323, at the current 5% cut, we would have to take a look at potentially doing that. That, of course, would be a worst-case scenario. If you look at the Budget Control Act going to $315,000 in the Army Guard, which would cause us to lose 640, that is 10% of our force. It would impact not only our warfighting mission, but it would have a significant impact on our ability to respond within the state. Now, we would do everything we could to make sure that the forces that are best structured to help our state would be the last to go, but we're not always... We can do everything we can, but we can't always make the decision on that. It's done at the federal level. So it would have a drastic and significant impact on our capabilities in the state, sir.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
If there's no other questions, I'm going to follow up on Representative Witt's question here, and then I'll make a statement afterwards so you don't get boxed in. But am I missing something here? We're really talking about an armory per 100 men. A rifle company is in our typical armories, so a loss of 300 is going to be a loss of three armories. A loss of 600 is going to be six armories. That's really in brass tacks what we're talking about. Is that not correct?
Senator Boquist, you're very close on that, sir. It comes down to the fact if they would say, if they take force structure, then we lose that organization. If they give us end strength and say, well, you need to get 300, then we could theoretically just take a couple from each armory and try and spread the pain. But if it comes back with actual force structure cuts, like if they say this unit has gone away, say the 1186th MPs in Milton Freewater, if they take that unit away, it would be difficult for us to maintain that facility, or we would have to try and remission that to perhaps take a platoon out of a company at another location and move them there. Because we absolutely do not want to close our armories if at all possible. Sir, you bring up a great point. That's really what it comes down to.
Well, I don't want you to comment, but I think Representative Witt is absolutely correct, and I think most of the members of this group here have got the experience that, I mean, what we're looking at is the National Guard is 10 cents on the dollar of the active component.
Yes.
I mean, I can personally speak that General Ordinaro, the Chief of Staff of the Army, does not like the reserve components, and so they'd rather steal the money, take it from the National Guard, which is the most cost-effective and the most community-based, and stick the money in their own pockets. And again, I don't want anybody in the military uniforms to comment, but I think we've seen this, I think.
Yes.
There's some of us, well, at least four of us here, that are old enough to experience this before in the military. We know exactly what the deal is. And everything we can do to stop them from doing that, you know, benefits the nation and benefits the state, which, of course, politics are local. Am I missing the point? I think that's your point.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Mr. Chairman, and I just... General, you said that it is a priority of yours to stay in our communities. Our communities are very well served by your presence. We want you there. Those of us who have had the occasion to need your services are very grateful that you are there in our communities. So whatever we can do to be of assistance, please feel free to let us know as committees and us as individuals as well.
Thank you, sir.
Any other comments?
I have three closing thoughts before we leave. One is, I think several representatives made quick mention of, you know, interface with the legislature. I know the competitors across the river to the north in the Washington National Guard still have ways of doing legislative days, you know, at the same time to get their legislators involved so they understand what you do. That's a suggestion. The politics are local, and the best way to the community is that. And the challenge, I think, you have stated to our committee on the Senate side is that we've been at war for 12, 14 years, and the community is many times that doesn't know who's in the community. And trying to reestablish those bonds to the community is very, very important. And I think that would be helpful in the same way, because there's nothing like, you know, some silver-haired lady who's mad yelling at her congressman or a senator about what those evil people in Washington, D.C. are doing to help out the National Guard here and do the right thing. So community is an important thing. If there's no other questions, I greatly appreciate you. I appreciate all of the service of all of the airmen and soldiers out here, the sacrifices you've made. I know most of you have been on deployments, been to the sandbox. We recognize that. Unfortunately, many times in this building, we deal on the negative and not the positive, so it may seem that way. But I think the entire legislature, you know, owes all of you, you know, a debt, along with the rest of the service members, including the Marine Corps, Coast Guard, Air Force, so on and so forth. If there's no other questions at this time, we're going to go ahead and close the meeting. Appreciate all of it, unless you have one final comment you want to make. I see you leaning forward for the political opportunity. You are a presidential appointee or governor appointee, so you're a politician too.
Chair Boquist, committee members, I just want to thank you for the opportunity of taking this interest. Any chance we have to meet with you, and so we look forward to in the future getting you out to some of our formations and meeting and seeing some of the capabilities that we had. And when the weather gets better, we'll try during legislative days to bring some of our equipment out and have some of our soldiers and airmen kind of show you that. And if you'd like a further interest, we'd love to either meet you in your communities or take you to some of our facilities so you can see and be familiar with some of the capabilities. It's the best part of my job is showing up at an armory and seeing some of these young, I call them kids, but they make you feel really good about what you do. So. Sure, community members, thank you again for this great opportunity.
If there's nothing else, we're going to end the informational hearing for the day in terms of the Senate.
And we will close for the House.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you.